Thank you very much, Kay. I appreciate that. And I, too, would like to especially thank all of the committee for inviting me to be here and everything, that this is really a very, very special treat, not being up here on the podium, but, you know, being here at Mount Eagle. It's such a beautiful setting and beautiful love. It's, you know, like I was sharing with Charles this morning, is the love is here as soon as you walk into the place. The greeting is so warm, the people are so warm, and it's just wonderful to share that with you and for you to share all your love and blessings with me. So it's just everything that I, even before I think I have a need, you have met it and taken care of it, and I appreciate it so much. Thank you. I always have trouble getting started. You know, I like Casey. I wish that I could tell jokes, but my thing is, it is a joke how I tell jokes in my family. As I write down the punchline, and you know, and I try to explain the joke, and my son-in-laws will take the punchline and say, yeah, maybe we can make something out of that, maybe we can't, everything. So joke telling is not my thing. I end up making a lot of funnies, but it's usually just unconsciously that I make the funnies instead of doing it deliberately. And like Casey also, this is not my favorite thing to do, but it's usually one of those things where I learn about myself again, something new and different each time, and I'll share a little bit of that with you. I've been awake since 5:30 this morning, doing a lot of talking with my higher power, and what am I supposed to talk about? And there's, you know, I've been so blessed with so many wonderful things that have happened to me that I, you know, oh, I got to share about this, and I got to share about that, and I got to share about that. And it's just been about these 10,000 thoughts popping in and out of my head. So I hope, you know, as these thoughts pop in and out again, you guys can keep up with me where I'm going or what I'm doing. But I have been around the fellowship for a long time, and for that I'm truly grateful. You know, Mickey and I were sitting here, and I think it was about 1980 when I started going to area assembly, and I first met Mickey. And Mickey was one of those old-timers that was up there at area assembly, and I got off to the side, and I just bitched and griped all day because they weren't doing things right in my district. You know, all those old timers, they just weren't listening to things and doing it my way. And now to find out that I'm one of those old timers in my district, and you know, and I'm the one that's, whenever the newcomers are coming around, is, you know, trying to be more gentle than I thought those old timers were with me whenever they told me no, I couldn't do it. I don't know whether they were really as tough as I perceived them to be, or whether it was just my chip on my shoulder, my sensitivity, that I heard big, loud no's instead of just the, what I perceive that I give is the gentle, loving no's. So, but anyway, that's probably all perception too. To get a little bit started on my story, my sharing me with you, is that I was born in Kansas many long years ago. 1939, for those of you that, you know, that's important too. 1939, so I was thinking this morning that probably my earliest memories was that Daddy had gone off to World War II, and I can now today, I get honest enough to share with the fact that my mother was having an affair, you know, but during the time that he was gone off to war. And this is one of the things that I would not share for years and years, because it was always my father that was the bad guy, and mother was so wonderful, wonderful and everything, that I would not even admit to myself that, you know, mother wasn't as wonderful as I had put her up on that pedestal, that she had some character faults and too. You know, she was a 20-year-old stuck home with two kids, and so, you know, I today can have the compassion on why she probably was having the affair. But even as a 4 or 5-year-old, I can remember those feelings of embarrassment, something is wrong, we're hiding something, that this is not complete honesty. And so that's some of my earliest feelings that I remember, is the trying to hide what was going on at our house. Daddy came home from the war, and the day that he arrived back in this little town, we moved to Wichita. And the years in Wichita was fairly, comfortable for me. That was from first grade through about sixth grade. I can today say that we probably lived on the wrong side of the tracks, but at that time I didn't realize that we were on the wrong side of the tracks. But, we were the kids that had the baseball bat and ball. We were had the swing in the backyard. We got to go to the circus or the parade or whatever was coming to town and everything. I had roller skates, there were sidewalks, we got to do a lot of roller skating, bicycle riding and everything, and always just lots of kids around to play with. I can remember some very special teachers at that time, and I felt like I was the teacher's pet. And it was, just good time in Wichita. Then when I was in sixth grade, I guess one of the other things there is that during this time, mother and daddy worked very hard during the week, but then on the weekend was always the partying, the dance. And that's some of the other memories, is when they were gone to the dance, being left with a babysitter, and that feeling that the babysitter was not really capable of taking care of us, and being frightened that there would be some type of emergency, and the babysitter wasn't old enough or responsible enough to take care of us. And the other thing was one of those Saturday nights, mother and daddy was fighting, and I woke up and could remember seeing mother had a butcher knife to keep daddy from hitting her and this type of thing. And being so, so frightened, and can remember at that time saying to myself, I will never subject my children to anything like this. But of course, I subjected my children to those type of things, and even worse. So I definitely did not plan on marrying an alcoholic. When I was in the sixth grade, because of the fighting and arguing that mother and daddy was doing in Wichita and everything, daddy did a geographical cure, and we moved to a farm that was about 100 miles away. When we got to this farm, the house had been used as a barn, so it was a lot of camping out that summer while they completely stripped down this house and redid it. And we were there for a year without electricity, and from the sixth grade until I left there to get married, we never did have indoor plumbing. So, and in Kansas, whenever you got to go out to that house in the middle of the winter, it is very uncomfortable. In Wichita, I probably didn't know how poor we were, but when we got to the farm, I knew we were poor. I knew there was people that had indoor plumbing, that there was people that had electricity. We had this big, huge, beautiful refrigerator and no electricity to plug it into, type of thing. And I was always ashamed of that house because of the fact that it had been used as a barn, and now we were living in the barn. I realize today that that is, kind of a status symbol if you take a barn and converted it. But back in the 50s, that was not a status symbol. So that's some of my character defects that I brought into the alcoholic marriage with me. I was very ashamed of a lot of my beginnings, and I blame Daddy. If he had not moved us from Wichita to that farm, I would be happy. And the blame and shame is something that I have carried, most of my life, and it's one of my character defects that I work on still today. Not near as severe, it doesn't control my life, but whenever I start having problems or get that churning going again and everything, I can usually look around and it's, because of the shame or I'm getting ready to blame you for whatever is going on inside of me. This farm was located outside of a little town, Fall River, had 200 population. There was 40 in the high school, in 4 years of high school. There were six in my graduating class, four girls and two boys. And one of those things where, I was valedictorian on the class. And like, you know, Casey, is I got good grades. I love to read. And so I would escape most of the time by reading. And whenever you read, you learn a lot. You know, so it's easy to do well on tests. I never knew how to apply anything that I learned or read or whatever. But I had a lot of useless facts up here all the time swirling around. But also by being valedictorian of a class of six, it was no big deal. It was one of those things where if I could accomplish it, then it must not be much. So I could discount whatever the accomplishments that I had. Like Casey, I came there as a sixth grader and I was the new kid. And when I graduated 6 years later, I was still the new kid. And I still never did feel like I totally was accepted or belonged to that little class. I was a valedictorian, I was a class president, I was a cheerleader, but again, I discounted all these things. Well, there's nobody else to be class president, so, you know, she's class president, or I was class president. So, my feelings of insecurity and shame was with me. Don, who was to become my husband, you know, his high school sweetheart, he was a senior and I was a sophomore, and we dated for that 1 year. He went off to the Navy, and for the 2 years that he was gone, you know, I stayed true blue to him and wrote to him every day, and he came back, you know, I think I saw him something like 60 days out of those 2 years, and he came back and we got married. And even as an 18-year-old, I realized, you know, that we had grown up and changed a lot in those 2 years, but, you know, he had orders to Hawaii, and it'd be fun to go to Hawaii for a while, and, you know, you go and you have a good time for a while, and then you can always get divorced and get out of this and everything and come home. So that was my attitude on getting married, but I found out it's not as easy to get a divorce as I thought it was. Got to Hawaii, and, oh, and the other thing, in high school, you know, he started dating me because he realized that he was drinking too much, and he started using me as a control, you know, if he was out with me or the fact that I didn't like the drinking and everything, and he didn't drink as much. And think what that did to my ego. He didn't drink because of me. He loved me so much that he didn't drink. And that was wonderful in high school. But do you know what it was like 15 years later? Where he was not able to control his drinking? We went to Hawaii, and of course, you know, even over there, the first coming back to when he didn't come home every night after work, like I thought he ought to come home every night after work, the being alone and being frightened, wanting to go back home, wanting to get out of the marriage, but also too much false pride to ask my parents or anybody else to help me get back to Kansas. I didn't really want to go back to Kansas. I didn't like Kansas. I didn't like farm. I didn't like daddy. I didn't want to be in the marriage. I didn't know where I wanted to be or what I wanted to do, but I just always knew that there was someplace else I needed to be, and I would be happy if something else was going on in my life. In Hawaii, the babies started coming. We ended up having three kids in 4 years. And it's one of those things, we weren't speaking or we weren't talking to each other, but the babies kept coming. So. We did an awful lot of that, getting mad, making up. And the making up was wonderful. But then of course, you know, there was always the geographical cure. When we leave Hawaii, the next duty station will be better because those drinking buddies that are leading him astray will not be at that next duty station. And he will stay home and he will be the husband that I want and he will be the father that he should be to the kids and everything. And of course, the next duty station we got there, and the drinking buddies were still there. Different names, different faces, but, you know, they were still at the club, just like he was all the time. So with the moving around with the Navy, I really got very, very dependent on Don, you know, that I was not working at the time, so he was strictly all the financial support that I had. And with moving around so much of the time, is that he became the only really emotional support that I had. And he became my God. I kept putting him up on that pedestal and trying to worship him and trying to do all these things that I thought a good wife was supposed to be doing. And he just kept falling off all time, and he kept disappointing me one more time and disappointing me over here and things like that. He did 22 years in the Navy. So we did a lot of moving around. We lived in some wonderful, interesting places, and I'm very grateful for that. We lived in Guam and Alaska and Hawaii and London, lots of time in California, moving back and forth. When we were in London, and like I share so much of the time, if you go, you know, from here to point A to point B, you realize how crazy it is. But when it takes you 15 years to get to point B, you have lived in this alcoholic situation for so long and everything that you think it's normal to constantly be in this turmoil and upset and the craziness that's going on. While we were in London, a little bit about my kids first. Debbie is the oldest one. Kevin was 15 months later. Melissa was 2.5 years later. Melissa was definitely an accident, but she's the best accident that ever happened to me. We were in London, and Kevin was diagnosed with leukemia. And it's, you know, one of those things of, you know, why God? Why Kevin? Kevin was one of these kids that was just super kid. He was about 2 or 3 grades advanced. He was, at the time he was diagnosed, he was 9 years old. And he was, you know, bred on level 4 or 5 grades ahead. He was, you know, a couple grade levels ahead in school. He played the shortstop on his little league team. He was when he got old enough to be a weeblo, even with the disease of leukemia, he was still able to do every one of his little weeblo badges. And he seemed to be just the focus or the center of our family, that each one of us felt, you know, we had very, very special ties to Kevin. And a lot of it was just the fact that Kevin was just interested in the whole world, so he was interested in anything that we were doing or involved in. A very special little boy. So when he was diagnosed with leukemia, of course it was, you know, why God? Why Kevin? If some kid has to have leukemia, why not that kid down there that you knew that was going to grow up and be the juvenile delinquent and end up in jail and everything? Why this special little boy that has so much potential? Well, the Navy, done, you know, the Navy transferred us back to San Diego, which we asked to go back to San Diego, that we had been there, stationed there before, knew the area, knew that they had good medical facilities there. And when I got to San Diego, you know, I was going from chaplain to church to all over, all these ministers, trying to find some relief of why God, why are you doing this to me? And I finally got to this Presbyterian church, and the minister there says, you know, I don't know why. You know, that's beyond my understanding. The only thing I know is that God will give you the strength to get through this if you will allow him to. And I kind of liked that answer better than I had gotten any place else. So I started going to this Presbyterian church. And the other thing that was happening right at that time is that there was a woman that was very much wanting a deeper spiritual life from this church, that she felt like it was very, very superficial, and was starting a prayer group and wanted, you know, something more. And this prayer group started, and I started going to it. And Kevin was kind of the catalyst for that prayer group, that it was okay for people to admit that they were praying for Kevin. It was okay for them to have some spiritual awakening while they were praying for Kevin. It was, and it became okay for me to admit that I needed help with Kevin. The wonderful part about this is that in this prayer group, there ended up being six women that were either AA or Al-Anon. The particular little, this church worked on a deacon, neighborhood deacon concept. The deacon for my neighborhood was June. And she came to my house, and we had an instant bond because her brother had died of leukemia when she was a child. And the very first visit to my house, she recognized the disease of alcoholism in our home without ever seeing my husband. All she did was talk to me and realize how crazy our house was. She was able to start sharing with me about AA and Al-Anon. She got me some literature, and she kept coming back, and she kept visiting me. She wanted to take me to some meetings, but my husband would not allow me to go to meetings, and I was sick enough that I did what he told me to. He wouldn't let me go to meetings because he was so sure that if I went to meetings, the Navy would find out, and the Navy would kick him out. And he, by this time, he had something like 18 years, and we had to just hang in there long enough to get that retirement check. But with June, and with the prayer group, and with going to the library, and checking out the AA and the Al-Anon books, I was able to accept that alcoholism is a disease. I can remember, you know, and that's one of the reasons that I'm so big on public information and putting the books in the library, is because the books were in the library when I needed them. I checked them out. I was ashamed of them when I was checking them out. You know, I probably would have been more comfortable checking out some porno stuff than I was of checking out this stuff on alcoholism. But when I got those books home and started reading them, I read that AA big book, and every page of that AA big book was my husband. I could understand what was going on with him. And because of, you know, Kevin having the disease at the time, I was able to accept alcoholism as a disease. You know, when they finally told me that AMA recognizes it as a disease, insurance pays for it, it must be a disease if that happens with it. I accepted it as a disease, and I knew that Kevin didn't have any choice about whether he had leukemia. Don didn't really have any choice about whether he had alcoholism or not. I could see the personality changes in both of them. I could see how the drugs affected both of them. And I could also recognize my reaction to both of them. As a mother, I wanted to do nothing more than to love and to take care of my son. But how much of the time it was just physically too demanding. I just got too tired, too exhausted, too irritable, too short a temper with Kevin as I was trying to take care of him, as I also did with my husband. But because of June, you know, I got into the steps, I started working the steps, I asked God to come into my life. He did. He was with me on a daily basis as I was going through Kevin's illness. And because I had the strength and the power of him during that time, I know that he is real, that there's no doubt in my mind at all that God is there, and he's there for me. Kevin did pass away, but I share the thing that about a week before his death, we were living out in San Diego on one of the mesas out there, and we could see the water. And we were, and with California, you don't have as many beautiful sunsets as you do around here. It doesn't rain as much, you don't have as many clouds, and you really do need the clouds to make the beautiful sunsets. But there was an especially gorgeous sunset that night, and Kevin and I sat out on the table on the patio, and we did an awful lot of talking about, you know, how wonderful heaven is going to be, and how much we were both looking forward to being in heaven and being with God. And he passed away a week later, and the day of his funeral, again, was just exactly the same type of sunset. And to me, that was my sign from God. Kevin is in heaven. Kevin is okay. God is my babysitter, and you can't have any better babysitter than God. So,
lost my train of thought. Anyway, because of recognizing, you know, the fact that alcoholism was a disease, I was able to release Don to allow him to do the things that it was necessary for him to do, to turn him over to God. I knew that God was taking care of Kevin. I knew God would take care of my drunk also. He was out there still, you know, drinking, still being out late at night. I was able to go to bed and go to sleep. And to me, that was a miracle, to be able to go to sleep while he was still out doing whatever he was doing. About 6 months before Don stopped drinking, the violence started in our house. I was sharing with somebody this morning on making decisions. The thing that really drove me crazy is I want a divorce. I love him. I can't stand it anymore. I got to get out of this. And just these thoughts going crazy in my head, you know, and I never knew from minute to minute on whether I was going to divorce him, kill him, murder him, commit suicide, or you know, love him and accept him. Once I came to accept that it was a disease, then it was very easy to say, I am going to stay in this marriage. You know, he is sick, and I will stay with him. Well, once the violence started, then I was just as comfortable with the decision that I am not going to subject my children or myself to the violence. And December 8th was our anniversary. He had gone out and celebrated our anniversary without me. So, after I had, you know, gotten the new dress and gotten the babysitter, and I'm sitting and waiting and waiting and waiting, and he finally came home about, you know, midnight or whatever type of thing. He started kicking the dog again, and when he started kicking the dog, I knew that I was probably going to be next and everything, so I took the kids and left. And at that time, I knew that that was the end of the marriage, that I would not be with him anymore. And I share so much of the time that before there was always the rationalization or justification of why I could not leave him now. And it was, you know, it was just before Christmas, and of course kids have to have their fathers at Christmas time. There was no way that you kicked the father out on December 8th. And my parents were coming to visit, and of course I, you know, would always in the past had to put up this front, you know, that we had this happy marriage whenever my parents were around. They were coming for Christmas, you know, and I wouldn't have kicked him out if they were coming. And besides that, the car wasn't running. And, you know, any other time I would have waited until I got the car running, and then I would have kicked him out. But this time, I was definitely, you know, comfortable with that decision that it was the end. Well, he did get to AA. He did get to the counselors at the Navy and everything. And, of course, about 3 weeks later, then he was back in the house again. So, but he did get sober, and he did stay sober for a long time. And it was one of those things, again, where it was time for us to move. In less than 90 days, we went off to Adak, Alaska. And that shows you how crazy I was, that I would go off to Adak, Alaska with less than 90 days of sobriety. It was a long trip from San Diego to Seattle, you know. But he managed to stay sober. We started having AA meetings in our home every fourth night, and it was, you know, so much better than it had been for years. In fact, one of the couples that was on ADAC at the same time, I just saw down at the Gulf Coast Roundup last weekend, and it's wonderful to be able to have that network of people that you run into all over the world of the AA and Al-Anon community. We did 2.5 years on ADAC, you know, total involvement with AA up there. I tried to get some Al-Anon meetings going, but never was really very successful. You know, there'd be two or three of us that would meet for a while, and then somebody would get transferred off the island, and it would just kind of fall by the wayside. So it was an open AA meeting in our house, and I attended most of those. Our kids went to bed almost every night with Don playing Chalk Talk to some drunk that was coming in and getting into AA. Came to Pensacola and got active in AA down there. I followed him around to an awful lot of open AA meetings and really enjoyed that. Learned a lot. I could hear the other alcoholics talking about how much they loved their families and how much their families meant to them. But still, they would go out and do these crazy things. They would go out and get drunk again. And because of hearing the love of the other alcoholics for their family, I finally came to accept the fact that Don loved his family. And I really think that that's the main reason he got sober, is because he knew that he had lost his son and that he was going to lose his daughters too. Five and a half, and sobriety comes, and it's supposed to be live happily ever after. And it doesn't always work that way. 5.5 years of sobriety, and he announces that he wants out of the marriage. Can you believe that? It was supposed to be me rejecting him, not him rejecting me. But he did leave me for another woman that had less than 90 days of sobriety and was the same age as our daughters. And that humbles you some and causes a lot of growth on my part and everything. God working in my life is the day that he left. Two beautiful AA ladies showed up at different times. Jean came and she sat and talked to me for about 5 hours. So I was not even alone that day that he left. And Jean had left to go back to her family, and Norma showed up within a half hour. Norma is one of these big, tough broads, you know, that she told me, get my ass in the car, and I got my ass in the car. I had no choice. If I didn't put my ass in the car, Norma would have done it for me. But Norma took me to Al-Anon meetings for 2 solid weeks. You know, every night we went to an Al-Anon meeting. And by, you know, the time the 2 weeks was up, I recognized, you know, Al-Anon was for me. And that, you know, was one of my comments to Norma, is the fact that I didn't need Al-Anon anymore since Don was left. The alcoholism was gone in our family, and I would just have to make a life of myself someplace else. Well, Norma didn't see it that way, but anyway. She, by the end of the 2 weeks, that she recognized the fact that I, you know, had made enough friends and commitments in Al-Anon and everything that I could get to the meetings by myself. But she is still one of the, you know, great gifts from God. And I appreciate it if you pray for Norma, because she's terminally ill right now. I just saw her last weekend, too, and that was a very special treat for me. So I did. You know, I was fortunate enough to know about the steps, to have my spiritual awakening, you know, even before I got active in Al-Anon. But to get active in Al-Anon and to have that fellowship, to have that love, and to have that acceptance that I had been searching for all my life and not knowing what I was looking for. I shared with somebody this morning, is a wonderful part about this fellowship is, you know, I'm scared to death whenever I get up here, but I just feel the love and the people that's wanting me to succeed and wanting me to do well up here. And that's, you know, you go into your meeting, and that's what I felt that first time that I walked into that meeting. I knew those people really cared about me. And it was wonderful. I was fortunate enough to go into a group where there was a lot of laughter, and that laughter kept me coming back. You know, that all day long it would be doom and gloom and pity, poor, pitiful Jeanette and everything, and then I go to the meeting and there was laughter. And I loved that, you know, and I kept going back for that laughter. I started going down to Panama City. It was the first conference that I went to, that there was 4 women went down there. And we just laughed and laughed and giggled all night. You know, and I can relate to these people that were laughing at 11 o'clock last night. That is what kept me in the fellowship, was to be able to be with the other people and to laugh and to have a good time. And we would laugh and talk all night long. And, you know, and going to area assembly was wonderful because every 3 months I knew that I was going to have another weekend like this. And it was, you know, I'd go up there and we'd have these long business meetings during the day. And, you know, and some of the business meetings was really boring. But, you know, but I knew that that night we were going to be back sharing again. And kept doing that. Then Betty Drake that was in my home group. And again, I drove all the way across Pensacola to the best group in town. You know, that it was something like a 45-minute drive, and I passed many groups getting there. But that was the group that had the laughter, that was the group that had the loving, that was the group that had the acceptance, that was the group that had what I wanted. As I got weller in the fellowship, a lot of times I stop at those other groups now on the way over there, and I find that the love is there, but I just didn't feel it in the beginning when I first started. But Betty Drake was the old timer in the group, and when it was time for to have another GR, and Betty, you know, said, "Jeanette, would you like to be GR? And I thought, God, I can't believe that Betty would trust me with this responsibility. Now remember, I stayed in this alcoholic situation because I did not have any skills or any way that I knew that I could possibly get out and take care of myself. And here was somebody that was willing to trust me to be GR and thought that I could do it. And I just, you know, ooh, yeah, I would like to do that since Betty wanted me to. And I started going to the area assembly and started meeting the wonderful people like Mickey and Fran and the other DRs that are up there and the coordinators, and I just, you know, very, very thankful that they were there when I got there. And once I got, you know, elected to GR, the next thing they wanted me to be district representative. And I got elected to that. And that was, you know, big time for me too. And of course, with my ego problem, I thought, you know, when they elected me district representative, I was supposed to know everything that was going on. And I was supposed to run the show. Well, I thank God that there was Carol that was in my district. And Carol was the one that was strong enough to challenge me and confront me with a lot of the things that I was doing. But it really forced me to get into the books and to find out whether I was right or whether Carol was right. But I thank God for Carol, because she did it to me face to face and was able to, you know, sometimes Carol was right and sometimes I was right. But at least we learned and grew together as district representative. I think, you know, that service really does challenge your program. As I could, you know, work a wonderful program whenever I'm sitting in a meeting and having all this love and from everybody that was there. But then to go home and try to, I could always blame the family. They don't have a program, and that's the reason, you know, hell is still going on at the home. And then to get into service, and when you're trying to accomplish something and you come again to the confrontation and know that these people are also working a program, but you're not seeing eye to eye on something. I learned in service that it's okay to have different ideas. I had grown up with a very domineering father. There was one way to do things, right way, his way. And that was the only way. And I, you know, my mother had been like a doormat, and I wasn't going to be a doormat, so I grew up just like my father. One way to do things, my way, and everything. Did not like it in him, but I didn't see it in myself until I got into service and started working with other people and having them confront me with it. It's wonderful to... But when that was a big light bulb and a big concept for me, is to realize that there was different ways of doing things. That an awful lot of times we can get from point A to point B, but we just take different roads and different routes and different methods of getting there. And I thank God that I, you know, had learned this before my girls got to be, you know, too old, and it's
where before I had said, do dishes, and you do dishes, by, you know, doing it, what, step one, two, three, just so, and everything. And they finally told me in Al-Anon, get out of the kitchen whenever they're doing dishes. Let them do dishes. And let them do it however they want to and everything. Al-Anon told me to get off my kids' backs and allow them to grow up and allow them to be independent. And I thank God for that. Where do I want to go? I got to share with you what the steps meant to me, because the steps is how I got to where I was. I learned about the steps, you know, way back in San Diego, and worked the steps to the best of my ability at that time. And I just thank God that, you know, that the steps keep changing for me daily. You know, as I go from place to place in my life and everything, they take on different meanings to me. The first, I'm kind of floundering right here because I really don't lost the train of thought of where I want to go. There are just so many good things in my life, and I realize I'm running out of time. But step one, we, the very first word, we, was very important to me, because I did not want to admit that I was powerless. If I was powerless, that meant that I was a failure. And I, you know, was so insecure within myself that I couldn't stand to be a failure again in any part of my life. But when I could hear that we, and look at you, and see how successful you appear to be, and you're out there saying that you're, you know, my concept, that you're a failure, and you can say that and admit it and everything, then it was okay for me to say that I was powerless too. And I need that we there for us to be together. Today I'm very thankful that I can say that I'm powerless over almost every situation. The only thing that I have any power over today is myself, my actions, my reactions. When I learned that I could act rather than react, you know, that was a big concept for me too, because I had always just reacted to whatever was going on. But in my life, was it manageable when I first came in here? I didn't think so. Because I compared myself all the time to the alcoholic. Look what he was doing and how crazy he was. I'm not unmanageable. When I really came to realize the fact that, you know, I never knew how I was going to react. I knew that whenever he came home, if I was crying, that would upset him so much. So every time, I am not going to cry. No matter what he does, I am not going to cry. He'd walk in the door and then the tears would just come all over the place and everything, the boo-hoo all over the place. Or else the fact that I am not going to be a ranting, raging bitch tonight. He'd walk in the door and there I was again. I never knew where my emotions were going or what I was going to be like at any time of the day. Came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And again, you know, I came to believe in that power because that power was there for me during Kevin's illness. And that power has been there for me during all the other crises in my life. Restore us to sanity. I didn't think I was comparing myself to the alcoholic. But when I stopped to think about, you know, how close I came to committing suicide, because I didn't think there was any way out, other way out. You know, and I just wanted out of where I was and what I was going on with me. If you're considering suicide, that is not good, sane thinking. So you know, stick around the program for a little while. To make that decision, and like I was sharing with Casey, is, you know, turning my will over to the care of God, I didn't want to do that because I was so afraid that this God would send me off to Africa to be a missionary or whatever. And I didn't want to be a missionary in Africa someplace. I was thinking this morning, you know, just think, by turning my will over to God, I get to come to Mount Eagle. I get to go to New York, you know. He has sent me some wonderful places since I am now willing to do what I think, what he wants me to. And it was a guy just as I understood him. I didn't understand very much about him at all in the beginning. I didn't know very much about him. But my God keeps changing as I come closer to him and understand more about him all the time. The God I have today is a very loving God. He's just like A.A. and Al-Anon. My God wants me to succeed. He wants me to be the very best Jeanette that I can possibly be. And the problem is that Jeanette tries to be another Juanita or tries to be another Mickey, and Jeanette gets all screwed up whenever she tries to be anything except Jeanette. He didn't create two Juanitas, you know. He didn't create two Jeanettes. He wants each of us to be special in our own very way, unique way. I get in trouble when I try to be Juanita, and I get in trouble whenever I try to force my children to be another Jeanette. They're not supposed to be another Jeanette. They're Debbie and they're Melissa, and they're wonderful the way they are. Made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. That I have made several inventories over the years as I've been in the program. And each one of them is as searching and as fearless as it can be at that time. He did not reveal to me all of me in the very beginning. I didn't have the self-worth or self-esteem, you know, and he just allowed me to know what I needed to know at that time. And as I, you know, get stronger in the program, I see that there's a few more weaknesses there that I can work on and that I can change a little bit. But I did the four-step inventory, you know, the way the big books did it. I did it with our blueprint for Al-Anon. I've just wrote out my story. And I still, whenever I am really hurting in some area today, I will still try to do an inventory on that particular area of my life. The last one was I had one of those supervisors from hell. Made my life miserable for about 4 years. So I did a lot of inventories about her and my relationship. And an awful lot of the relationship, you know, the thought was because she was exhibiting the same characteristics that I have a lot of problems with. Finally, you know, prayed enough for her that she got a promotion and moved on, you know. And I am very thankful that she got her promotion and moved on. But things like that still keep me very humble, keep me very dependent on the program. I come in here because of alcoholism, but I stay because I need it daily in all areas of my life. Admitted to God, to ourselves, and another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. I need a sponsor to help me with that because I am very good about conning myself and especially the blaming. Well, I react this way because you did that type of thing. If you didn't behave that way, then I wouldn't have to behave the way I do. And June, that lady back in San Diego, she was wonderful about, you know, I would start, I lied because, and she'd say, Jeanette, you lied. Oh. And it really made me stop and think, you know, and she was good about telling me what the exact nature of my wrongs were. But she also didn't tell me just the wrongs. She helped me to recognize the fact that I had assets too. And this is really tremendous for somebody that, you know, did not have any self-worth or self-esteem. Whenever she would point out to me, that's one of your strengths. Take that strength and build on it. Do something with it. Humbly ask him to remove. We're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects. It takes me a while sometimes to get ready to remove my defects of character, because a lot of mine has been survivor instincts, and they worked for me for years to survive in different areas. And then all of a sudden, you know, I realize I'm no longer in that situation where I have to defend myself that way. I can let go of that toughness or that shortness or that defense mechanism, whatever it is. I am ready to let go of it now and to find a better way of handling that situation. Made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. That willing, again, is the big word for me, is because an awful lot of it was I was not willing to. I was afraid that if I started making amends to you, then you would, you know, use that against me again and to hurt me again or whatever. And when I came to realize, you know, that all I had to do was make amends for my part in it, and I wasn't really responsible for what the reaction of the other people would be to it, it was much easier. But boy, did it take an awful lot of the weight away, that I didn't have to be afraid of that person anymore. I didn't have to avoid that person anymore. I could be Jeanette around that person again. Made direct amends to such people whenever possible, except when to injure them or others. I'm still making amends in a lot of ways. I think last February, my father had surgery out in Phoenix, Arizona. They still live in Kansas, but they have a motorhome and they do an awful lot of traveling, and they were in Arizona when he discovered that he had thyroid problems and was going to have surgery. And they were out there by themselves, and I flew out to be with them during the surgery, and a lot of the healing and making amends took place at that time. I was never really sure or capable that I would be able to be with him or be around him whenever he was sick or ill. And he turned out to, you know, because he's still a mean SOB, you know, so much of the time. And I can usually tell where I am in my program whenever I'll just accept, that's Daddy, you know. Daddy's been that way all his life. Daddy is not going to change. And, you know, and it is not Jeanette's job to change Daddy. And if I'm really strong and healthy in my program, I can accept him the way he is. Whenever I'm insecure about myself and I have to start defending myself, well, then I have to start changing him or trying to change him. But that week was one of the better weeks of my life, you know, to be out there with him and to be able to, he turned out to be a pussycat, and, you know, and he was sweet and he was loving, and I kept looking at it and, you know, is this Daddy? And, you know, and it was Daddy, and it was a good week. But I think there was a lot of growth and a lot of healing in that particular area. And that, I think also of another time, you know, back when I was brand new in the program and was one of those of checking my motives of why I was doing something. I learned that later, but anyway, this particular time was Don and I had had one of those big battles during the day, and we would stomp an offer around at each other, and came time to go to bed, and so, you know, I had learned in here, continued to take personal inventory, and when we're wrong, promptly admitted it. If I admit that I'm wrong, then he's got to admit that he's wrong too, right? By God, he's going to admit that he's wrong. So I, you know, very sweetly, I'm sorry for my part and, you know, what went wrong today. Nothing came back, except, by God, you ought to be sorry for what you did. So I've learned to check my motives of why I'm doing some things. I think my favorite step, of course, is the 11th step.
of sought through prayer and meditation. You had to teach me what the difference between prayer and meditation was. I didn't really know. My thoughts today is prayer is when I'm talking to God, and I also have to listen to God. When I first came into the program, I was so busy telling God what to do all the time, get him sober, take care of those kids, you know, get us some money, do this, God. I thought God was the butler, you know. Every time I issued an order, God was supposed to jump and take care of it for me. And I turned my wheel and my life over to him, and now I do a lot more listening for God than I do talking to him. Because God has been so good to me and blessed me in so much, many ways that I never expected possible. And having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message. And I laugh about the fact the message that I carried for quite some time was just that alcoholism was a disease. But that, you know, for me was such a relief in the beginning and such a big concept that I carried that for a long time. I finally came to realize that it was the spiritual message of the program that we're supposed to be carrying. The spiritual is what gets us into recovery. The spiritual is what makes the changes in our lives. The spiritual, you know, is just fabulous. I was sharing with somebody else this weekend, you know, that if God had given me, you know, the things that I was asking for, I would have shortchanged myself, that he has given me so much more and blessed me in so many other areas of my life that I didn't really expect, you know, like coming to Mount Eagle, being with you, getting to meet each one of you, and each one of you are very special in a different way. I got to be delegate, you know, and this is something that I would have never dreamed of or never expected. I got to go to New York to attend the World Service Conference. I got to go to Stepping Stones, the home of Bill and Lois Wilson. And that's almost like stepping on hallowed ground whenever you get there, and to sit at Bill Wilson's desk where he wrote, you know, the books and the literature and the wonderful things that we have in this program. To be able to sit at Lois's desk and to see her home, see the value that she put on things. I was so impressed because she labeled everything, you know, and it didn't make any difference whether it was some just little knick-knack, you know, something that looks like it came out of a Happy Meal. There was a little label there about who had given it to her. You know, the same type of little label for this little rinky-dink thing as there is for, you know, beautiful piece of silver or whatever. She put the same value on each gift that she received, rather than, you know, as I have a tendency to do, is, you know, I'll put more value on the things that are the big fat monetary. But it's taught me one of those lessons, is each gift is very, very important that we receive. What's it like today? I am so very, very thankful that because of this program, I'm able to have good relationships with my children, my daughters. They have grown up to be very beautiful women, mothers, wives, and I thank God for that. I got into the program just about the time that Debbie was going into adolescence. And I was such a controlling, domineering thing that, you know, that if it had not been for the program, I would have driven her completely away from me, that she would have had to escape to become her own person. And I thank God for the program that I was able to turn her over to God. You turn Kevin over, you turn a drunk over, then you turn an adolescent over too. And it works. She would be out there doing whatever teenage kids do, and I could truthfully say, God, I know you love her even more than I love her. Take care of her wherever she is and whatever she's doing. She gave us about a real miserable year when she was about 14 years old, but, you know, thank God for the other kids that she was around that turned her around. So the younger one, Melissa, you know, I dreaded the time when she turned 14. She turned 14, nothing happened. You know, we had a beautiful year. 15 was wonderful, 16, and whoo, we're going to get through this. She's not going to do these kind of things. Well, 17, and all hell broke loose. 17, she graduated from high school. The next month, she moved out of my house and moved in with this other 17-year-old boy, and, you know, and they, everything that could go wrong did go wrong. You know, he had some little rinky-dink job, you know, but he had appendicitis within a month, and so then there was no job at all, and they had an old car that she, Melissa, had to push to start, and Melissa was not the type that was used to pushing cars. And he really got into the drugs heavy, and so after about 9 months, you know, Melissa asked if she could come move back home, and I was very happy and thrilled to have her move back home. But she and there was about 8 girls then that ran around constantly, and in Pensacola, when you're an 18-year-old girl, you're cute, good-looking, and you got all those Navy guys down there, she thought she was in heaven. And, you know, one time I could say, you know, that this is not normal behavior for an 18-year-old kid. And then the next time I'd look at her, I'd say, hell, if I was 18, I'd be doing the same thing probably and everything. But she was running with a group that there was a lot of accidents, there was a lot of blackouts, there was a lot of, you know, really stuff going on. And again, I was thankful for the program that I could say, you know, that she needs to do whatever she has to do to get where she needs to be. And I guess she must have been about 23 when Doug came into her life. And, you know, once Doug came into her life, I guess she found whatever she was seeking. And she today does not have any problem with the drinking and with the drugs. And I'm just so thankful that today that she doesn't. They're married. They're in California. He's going to postgraduate school out there. And they paid for me to fly out to California. How many son-in-laws do you know that would pay for their mother-in-law to come visit? And I just thank God for that. The other daughter, Debbie, is living there in Pensacola. She's married to this wonderful guy, too. That they're completely different. Melissa and Doug are very much the young officer, the young yuppie. If it doesn't have a brand name on it, well, they don't want it. Hobie and Debbie are just the opposite, you know. If it's got a brand name on it, they don't want it. If it's not homemade, or, you know, made by themselves, well, then that's their thing. My thing with my parents moving into that old barn and converting it, you know, so that was always my nightmare, is that I would have to remodel a home. Their dream is that they bought Hobie's grandmother's house, and they have completely stripped that thing down and redid it completely. Moving bathrooms, rewiring it. I say that they left the studs, the tongue and groove ceilings, and the hardwood floors, and they've redone everything else. But while they were doing this, they got an opportunity to sell the house that they were in to get some more money so they could work on this old house. And I said, you know, why don't you come stay with me while you're working on your house? And they came for 6 weeks to 2 months, and it turned out to be 6 months. But because of the program, that turned out to be a very beautiful experience. It allowed me to be even closer in their life, to see how they interacted with each other and with the two grandkids and with the dog and the two cats, that we were all together in my little two-bedroom house. We were cozy for about 6 months. But because of the program, I knew what was my business and what was their business. And I knew when to keep my mouth shut and when to let them have their family interactions and everything. And I just thank God, you know, that it turned out to be such a wonderful blessing. When they left Labor Day weekend, little 7-year-old granddaughter is very special. And, you know, they moved out, and I thought, you know, they would definitely all be so excited about being in their house. They're still camping in their house. They don't have it fixed yet and everything. But I was surprised that Jennifer came back and spent the night with me, because she didn't want me to be alone that night. And Debbie, the next night, about 9 o'clock, I got this telephone call. And it was Debbie saying, Mom, I just can't go to bed without telling you I love you. And it was so wonderful for those 6 months of having those hugs and I love you every night before I go to bed. So because of the program, I have this type of relationship with my daughters. Share a little bit about where Don is and where what happened to him is that he and his future wife moved to Colorado, and within, you know, a period of time, he was back out there drinking. And all those things that had not happened yet has happened to him, you know, that he has been in jail, he has lost the driver's license, he has been hospitalized several times for the drinking. Last March, when I was in New York at the World Service Conference and wonderful things happening to me, he was in Colorado being hospitalized for alcohol-induced starvation. You know, but for the grace of God, it could have very easily been the other way because I drank with him as much for a long time. He has been sober since that time again, and he seems to be doing very well. He came to visit the girls, visit Debbie, and had a good time with him. And he says that he's, you know, first time in his life that he really feels happy and content with himself is where he is. So we're just all praying that this is his time and his miracle for him. But I appreciate it if you'd keep praying for him too, as we'd all do for all the alcoholics that are out there suffering. And I really thank you for your patience with me as I've jumped here and there and wherever, all around and everything. I thank you so again for the joy of being here with you. And please share with me this afternoon so I can take a little part of you back with me. Thank you very much. I love you.